Iran's parliament speaker says the 2015 nuclear deal was meant to lift sanctions on Iran. And what matters to the country now is removal of all bans, practically. More U.S. Republican lawmakers join calls for President Trump to step down as Democrats push for his impeachment over the storming of the Capitol. And a senior official of Scotland's pro-independence ruling party calls Brexit an unnecessary act of economic vandalism, demanding compensation. Marzia Hashemi, appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Iran, where the parliament speaker says the country will fulfill its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if other parties keep their side of the bargain. Mohammad Baqir Ghanibaf says Iran's nuclear accord with world powers is not, quote, a holy document. He says the deal was meant to lift sanctions on Iran, and what matters to the country now is the removal of all bans, practically. The top parliamentarian says Iran must be able to sell its oil, trade with the world, and have access to the global banking system. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of the multilateral pact in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. However, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has promised to re-enter the deal. Meanwhile, Tehran says there will be no fundamental changes in Washington's anti-Iran policy under the new U.S. administration. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the U.S.'s international policies are not dependent on its administrations, whether they are Republican or Democrat. Majid Takht-Ravanchi also slammed the Trump administration for its unconventional policies, noting that Washington's actions were unpredictable for observers both in and outside of the U.S. He said the policies which will be adopted by Joe Biden's administration may look different but will be the same at their core. Well, calls are growing among U.S. lawmakers to impeach President Donald Trump after he incited his supporters that led to the storming of the Capitol building on Wednesday. Democrats of the House of Representatives are set to introduce articles of impeachment on Monday. Nearly 200 Democrats have co-sponsored the articles on Saturday night. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has asked members to draft legislation aimed at invoking the Constitution's 25th Amendment that allows for stripping powers from a president unable to fulfill the duties of the office. Meanwhile, a growing number of Republican lawmakers have also joined calls for Trump to step down. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska has suggested Trump should resign immediately and consider leaving the party. Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania has also said he would consider impeachment because the president has disregarded his oath of office.
With just over a week before the departure of Donald Trump from the White House, a public emergency has been declared in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That after an unprecedented chaos and the violent storming of the Capitol building by Trump supporters in their efforts to force Congress to overturn the presidential election results. U.S. officials refer to these incidents as days of infamy, accusing Trump of directly inciting the mob to what they call shameful assaults on the American democracy. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the United States.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
The president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave Oval Office voluntarily. According to U.S. media, Democratic representatives have already prepared a draft article of impeachment that accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting the Capitol Hill insurrection. He will be the first American president to be impeached twice by the House. Democrats are not alone in their bid. Some Republicans have also joined their rallying cries against Trump.
The president is unfit, and the president is unwell, and the president must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily.
A recent joint Reuters-Ipsos opinion poll also shows 57% of Americans are in favor of Trump's immediate removal from office. 7 out of 10 of those who had voted for Trump in the November election also decried the recent storming of the Capitol building. Surprisingly, defiant Trump later denounced the violent protests and pledged for a peaceful transition of power. However, hours later, he once again took to his Twitter, saying he would not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. Twitter has now permanently suspended his account, saying several of Trump's posts violate the platform's policy against the glorification of violence. Trump says Twitter is banning free speech. With the traditional departure of a sitting president from Washington now off the table, security concerns are growing for Biden's inauguration. Photos and videos emerging from the Capitol seat show the extent of violence American rioters and white supremacists are capable of. Deaths and vandalism at the Capitol show the United States' much-touted slogan of democracy can be easily endangered by its very own citizens.
Scotland's pro-independence ruling party has called on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to pay billions of pounds in compensation for the growing costs and disruptions caused by Brexit. The leader of the Scottish National Party in the British Parliament said Johnson's Conservatives must apologize to Scottish businesses for the long-term damage caused by Brexit. Ian Blackford called Brexit an unnecessary act of economic vandalism pushed against the will of Scotland. Scots voted against Brexit in the 2016 referendum. Fishermen in Scotland and elsewhere in the UK are angered by their loss of access to the European market due to increased bureaucracy caused by Brexit. This has worsened by Johnson's failure to take back full control of fishing waters after the UK left the European Union on January the 1st. Let's cross over to London, joined by Professor of Binary Economics, Rodney Shakespeare. Well, your take on this, you've seen what the Scottish pro-independence ruling party is basically asking for compensation for their losses because of the Brexit move. Your take.
Well, when international agreements are broken, there is huge damage. Scotland is suffering. Roughly 2% per year, year after year, as the rest of the UK, and it requires compensation. This damage, the latest example, is the City of London can no longer trade in European company shares. Those shares can only be traded in Europe. Everybody loses. Scotland wants compensation. And I prophesy it will get the compensation from London, because if it doesn't, the pressure for Scottish independence will increase. And the other example of when you break agreements there is damage is the JCPOA, Iran nuclear agreement. Billions of damage have been done, and yet America and its craven, creepy, crawly allies, Europe, think that they can ask Iran to go back into the agreement without payment for all the damage that has been done. That is absolutely outrageous. Breaking an agreement, causing the damage, and then expecting to go back into it without a payment of compensation. I have great sympathy with the Scottish position. Their suffering result of the breach, and they expect, and they will probably get compensation.
Well, in general, I mean, when we look at, because, of course, Boris Johnson had promised to play hardball with the EU, But it appears did not get everything that, especially fishermen in the UK wanted, and exclusive rights. I mean, how is that going to affect the situation? So on the one hand, they don't have the same rights that they had in dealing with EU waters. And on the other hand, it appears, from what I understand of all of this, that the Europeans, though, still have access to British waters.
Yes, of course. Boris Johnson, living out the fantasy of the British Empire, in which the UK can tell other people what to do and we're in the stronger position. The reality is the other way around. And as a result, the overall consequences of Brexit from the weak position are that we lose out. And it's the same with any sort of agreement in future. If you think that you can outmaneuver the USA in trade negotiations, have another think. Little UK against the big USA, no. Sheer imperial fantasy lay behind the Brexit, particularly behind Boris Johnson and his cronies in the Conservative Party. But there you are. When you break agreements, there is damage. Somebody has to pay for it. Scotland will expect to be paid, and in due course, in years, will get paid.
Okay.
Iran must demand compensation, billions of dollars, for the loss that it has suffered in the breach of the JCPOA.
Thanks so much for being with us, Professor Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Binary Economics out of London. Moving on to other news now, staying in Europe, however, where more people on the continent fall victim to COVID-19 as the virus continues to rage on throughout Europe. In the UK, nearly 60,000 more people tested positive on Saturday, pushing its caseload to over 3 million since the pandemic began a year ago. A further 1,035 deaths take the overall fatalities there to more than 80,000. Britain is one of the worst-hit countries in Europe. Concerns grow since the country reported cases of a more contagious COVID variant last month. Elsewhere in Europe, the number of fatalities in Belgium has crossed 20,000. Now, according to Belgian health officials, more than half of the dead are reportedly from retirement care homes. Germany has so far recorded over 40,000 COVID-related fatalities and over 1.9 million confirmed cases. And now to Indonesia, where authorities there say they have located the position of two black boxes of an airliner that had crashed shortly after takeoff from the capital, Jakarta. The head of Indonesia's Transport Safety Agency has been quoted as saying that divers will start looking for flight data recorders that could be crucial to understanding the cause of the tragedy. The plane with 62 crew and passengers on board crashed on Saturday. It was heading to the city of Pontianak. Authorities say Boeing 737-500 was in good condition, but the flight had been delayed by 30 minutes due to heavy rain. So far, search teams have retrieved remains of some passengers and pieces of the plane from the crash site. Pakistani officials say power is gradually being restored to major cities after the national power grid failure plunged the entire country into darkness. Authorities say power supply has been restored in most areas of Punjab province, as well as the southern port city of Karachi. They, however, say people in some areas in Lahore and Karachi remain without electricity. Saturday night's outage was Pakistan's second major power breakdown in less than 3 years. The power minister said the latest blackout was caused by an engineering fault in southern Pakistan. He said experts are trying to determine the exact location of the fault, which they have not yet been able to find yet. A roadside bomb has killed 3 people, including a spokesman for the government's security service in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The Interior Ministry says a journalist-turned-spokesman for the Public Protection Force was killed, along with two colleagues, after the bomb ripped through their vehicle. Two people were also injured in the incident. No group has claimed responsibility, but the Interior Ministry, in its statement, blamed the Taliban for the attack. Kabul has witnessed a series of bomb attacks and targeted killings in recent months. The violence has continued despite the government and Taliban negotiators having resumed talks in Doha aimed at bringing a lasting peace to the war-torn country. Now, Yemen's National Committee for Prisoner Affairs has confirmed the Saudi-led coalition has stopped several prisoner swap deals in Ma'arab. If implemented, the agreements would see the exchange or release of hundreds of prisoners from both sides. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
The parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen's Ma'arib have halted the process of 10 prisoner swap deals that would release more than 300 prisoners from both sides. The exchange was a part of an agreement reached recently between the warring local parties. An official of the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs blames the mercenaries for the halt.
When tribal mediators are involved in the release of the prisoners, the mercenaries stop them. This is also true about these exchanges that include more than 300 prisoners. The mercenaries are not one party, but rather they are several parties. And whenever we agree with one party, the other side fails it.
This comes while the Yemeni army has made significant achievements in advancing towards the city of Ma'arib to liberate it. Halting the prisoner swap will put more pressure on the Yemeni army to stop the advance of coalition forces on the ground.
The coalition forces play several cards to stop the army's advance toward Ma'arib in order to win a battle that will liberate the city. Halting the prisoner exchange is one of those. This is another effort by Saudi-led coalition to pressure the Yemeni army.
The prisoners' committee was able to liberate hundreds of prisoners during 2020 through local negotiations without any international mediation. However, the Saudi-led coalition seeks to stop the humanitarian process.
Thousands of Yemenis are still in prisons waiting for the United Nations to stop the delays in the release and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to commit to its obligation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
People in Kazakhstan are heading to the polls to cast their ballots in the parliamentary elections. 11 million Kazakhs are eligible to vote on Sunday. The governing Nur Otan party of President Qasym Jomart Tokayev is expected to sweep, as the only registered opposition party in the country is boycotting the vote. The National Social Democratic Party called this move a protest against a rigged system. International observers have long questioned the fairness of elections held in the ex-Soviet country since its independence. Tokayev, who came to power in 2019, had pledged gradual political reforms in the country but has continued the policy of his predecessor, Nursultan Nazarbayev. And with that story, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The third point is that, as I said, sanctions are undoubtedly a crime committed by the U.S. They are a blow delivered on the Iranian nation at the hands of the U.S. However, ingenious Iranians have made the most of this attack and this enmity. In other words, they have achieved certain things despite the foolish attempts made by the enemy. Our people, our youth, our officials, our scientists, and our political and social activists have used the sanctions as a means to increase national self-sufficiency. As you know, the U.S. has imposed secondary sanctions. In other words, it says to all companies and all countries that they do not have the right to give Iran such and such a product that it needs.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Naturally, we will not get what we need from the outside. However, this has caused certain people inside the country to think of producing them inside the country, as they saw that they cannot get them from the other countries. And this has happened in numerous cases, hundreds of cases, not just one or two. For example, we needed trainer jets, but they would not sell them to us. So what did we do? We embarked on building advanced trainer jets called Kauthar inside the country. If they had sold us trainer jets, we would not have built them inside the country today. Or many of our machines and factories needed various pieces and components. But the enemy had imposed sanctions on them, and he would not let us import them. At first, they said that dual-purpose components, the ones that can be used for both military and non-military purposes, were under sanctions. Later on, they extended it to other components and did not let us buy them. Nonetheless, that measure helped us launch a movement to build them inside the country.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
President-elect Joe Biden has formally announced many of his cabinet picks, boasting the most diverse cabinet in United States history. So who are these appointees? What are their records? And what are we really going to see from this incoming administration? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Joe Biden, whose campaign was practically dead in the water barely a year ago during the Democratic primaries, is now the president-elect of the United States. Things took a surprising turn when, during the Democratic primaries, several candidates all dropped out simultaneously and pledged their support behind Joe Biden, making the race a de facto head-to-head between him and Bernie Sanders. This Machiavellian move, with Obama making a few phone calls behind the scenes, cemented Joe Biden's status as the so-called frontrunner and saw the race narrow in his favor. Bernie Sanders soon dropped out and, just like he did in 2016, rallied behind the Democratic nominee without any opposition, rolling over and abandoning his grassroots movement of workers without obtaining any policy concessions from Biden. Bernie Sanders supporters and the progressive wing of the party were told once again that they absolutely needed to vote for the Democratic nominee for Biden because Donald Trump was an existential threat to the United States and that Biden was somehow the lesser of two evils. The Democratic Party knew it could count on them. It knew it could count on millions of Bernie supporters who had been sheepdogged back into the party. So why bother appeasing the left? Instead, we saw the Democratic Party invite neocon war criminals like Colin Powell to speak at their convention. The formation of groups like Republicans for Biden. Or even worse, the heinous Lincoln Project, a group of neoconservative war criminals from the Bush era like Rick Wilson, Bill Kristol, and Dick Cheney's daughter, making the case for Joe Biden. In essence, the Democratic Party and Biden's campaign tried more to appeal to right-wing voters and Republicans than to the left wing of their own party because no one was pressuring them from the left. And besides, that's exactly what Democrats are anyway. They are right-wingers. Even policies supported by most Americans, both Republican and Democrat, like universal health care, were frowned upon by Biden. Biden flat out said that he would veto Medicare for All. Just looking at Joe Biden's record, having spent 40 years in Congress catering to credit card companies, to Wall Street, to the fossil fuel industry, authoring the 94 crime bill and jailing scores of young African-American men, helping to start the Iraq War and supporting virtually every U.S. military intervention, Joe Biden even shamelessly bragged about working with segregationists. Despite all of this, Americans were told that they needed to blindly pledge their vote for Joe Biden in order to get rid of Trump. We heard over and over how Americans must put aside their grievances, shut up, and vote for the blue war criminal because he was supposedly different from the red war criminal. In the words of Joe Biden's own wife, voters were told to swallow a little. All of this under the premise that once Joe Biden was elected, voters would be able to push him left. So here we are, months later, Joe Biden has won and been declared president-elect. And already he's walked back several of his campaign promises, including canceling student loan debts and rolling back Trump's immigration policies. Not only that, but he's made several key appointments to his cabinet, many of them familiar faces, old pals from the Obama days. The same people who took the United States from two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to seven wars in Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan. The same people who expanded the NSA's mass surveillance programs, who sold billions of dollars to the Saudi Arabian regime in order to commit genocide in Yemen. The same people who dismantled the anti-war and Occupy movements. The same people who gave bailouts to Wall Street while forcing millions of Americans out of their homes. The same corporatist criminals and their neoliberal policies who led to Trump in the first place. So while Trump picked a cabinet of crooks who are DC outsiders, Biden also picks a bunch of crooks, but at least they're DC insiders. In fact, this very much pleases the liberal elites and the corporate establishment media. Why? Because of diversity, allegedly. Joe Biden bragged that his cabinet is the most diverse in United States history. These appointments have, of course, been lauded and praised by the mainstream media because they mean nothing in terms of structural change and have no effect on the goals of the US empire. The liberal elites and the media establishment can continue to pretend that they celebrate minorities and people of color while oppressing those very same groups, both at home and abroad, under the veil of intersectional, rainbow-colored imperialism. So far, Joe Biden has appointed seven women to his White House communications team. He also appointed Neera Tanden to head the Office of Management and Budget. This is the same Neera Tanden, Clinton aide, who suggested in an email that Arab countries should pay the United States with their oil for invading them. Biden has tapped Avril Haines as the Director of National Intelligence, a former deputy director of the CIA, and an architect of Obama's horrific drone program, which has killed countless civilians across the Middle East. But I guess we shouldn't worry, right? Because she's a woman, and according to the New York Times, she's also a brown belt in judo, a pilot, and turned an old bar into a bookstore. Biden's foreign policy advisor, Tony Blinken, will now be his Secretary of State. Blinken is another familiar face from the Obama administration and a supporter of the imperialist wars on Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He signaled that Biden would continue to use the CSAR Act sanctions, keep U.S. troops inside of Syria, and continue occupying Syria's oil, just as Trump has done. Yet according to The Guardian, these minor transgressions should be overlooked because Blinken can apparently speak French and play the guitar. So I'm sure this will be very appreciated by many Syrians who are currently starving under America's sanctions. Or what about Biden's pick for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, an African-American woman who also happens to serve as the vice president on leave to a Swiss mining company called Glencore, which is currently facing corruption charges in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These are just a few of the wonderful imperialists and corporatists that Joe Biden has appointed to his cabinet under the banner of so-called diversity. So joining me to discuss these cabinet picks further is Kevin Gostola, journalist and managing editor at Shadowproof. It's good to have you on, Kevin. How are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Kevin, you've been doing some great coverage on Joe Biden's new cabinet picks. We've been seeing a lot of familiar faces from the Obama days. Is that just a coincidence?
Well, what we're seeing are the people who have the leadership in the Democratic Party, the people who are going to be boosted. That's an amalgamation of Clinton Democrats, and then you have Obama Democrats. These are kind of the establishment factions that have sort of been at war with each other. Well, they've always had a shared interest to suppress any kind of insurgency from the wing of the party that I usually call the Sanders wing or the Sanders Democrats or maybe the Justice Democrats. And so politically, that's what we see happening. And, to be quite honest, the progressives just really don't have much power to match the influence of the Obama Democrats or the Clinton Democrats. And so what you have is, especially when it comes to foreign policy, you have, the weakest of appeals to liberal imperialism, basically. Like, it's the disagreements, the arguments are over whether you're going to have a more humanitarian kind of foreign policy that is still interventionist, or you're going to just ditch human rights entirely and show force and wield it with a kind of iron fist globally. And so what you're getting now is the alternative brand of U.S. empire that Biden is about to put forward. We've had 4 years of Donald Trump. We've seen what that could do. It turned off the entire globe, but that doesn't mean that what we're going to get from Joe Biden is going to necessarily be, you know, peace and human rights.
Speaking of foreign policy and empire specifically, can you tell us a bit more about Biden's new defense secretary? We're hearing praise from the media that he is the first black man to lead the Pentagon.
His name is Lloyd Austin, and he's a remarkable figure because it seems like no matter what in the United States, you can't keep people out of our government who have past in the Iraq War. Lloyd Austin is the fact that he was involved in leading the invasion of Iraq, and has boasted about going so quickly from, I believe, Kuwait to the Baghdad city in like a record amount of time. He was able to move forces and go in there and seize Baghdad. And this is his, what he considers to be the most honorable part of his military career, if you read it. And then he pairs it, I think, disingenuously with being involved in the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. However, he and Joe Biden and other Democrats are terrible at how they spin the Iraq withdrawal, because those troops were only, for the most part, removed expeditiously because they were afraid that the Iraqi government was going to start holding U.S. soldiers accountable for war crimes, which was a thing that was a sticking point to a status of forces agreement. So any work that was done to ultimately remove troops from Iraq, first off, I don't see that being like, hey, a tribute to you for removing forces that shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's like, okay, you led this and you know how to remove invaders from a foreign country. Like, great.
Right.
But then there's the issue of the fact that he was at a company called United Technologies that within the last year completed a merger with Raytheon and is now part of one of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the world. There is some truth to the fact that, like, I shouldn't treat him any differently than other Pentagon secretaries. So we've heard that he's a black man, and we should be excited because we're going to have the first black Pentagon secretary in United States history. Okay. But he's also the first black Pentagon military industrial complex leader of the entire world. You know, that's his claim. That's going to be his claim to fame too. And he'll be following in the footsteps of Mark Esper and James Mattis and Patrick Shanahan, who were Trump's defense secretaries, and they all came from defense contractors or weapons companies. In fact, Mark Esper, who he's succeeding, came from Raytheon. So it's as if Raytheon has completely taken control of the Pentagon. Essentially, the revolving door isn't even really a revolving door anymore. It's just a complete pipeline from Raytheon to the Pentagon in order for it to funnel money into the coffers of Raytheon for the bombing of children in Yemen or wherever Saudi Arabia might need us to assist them in the Middle East next.
Kevin, thank you so much for your amazing reporting, your insight, and all your analysis. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So, Kevin, what about all these women that Biden has appointed as well? Because the mainstream media is saying we should all be happy that he's putting so many women in key positions of power. However, when you look at the records, Avril Haines, for example, you know, Joe Biden boasts that he has the most diverse cabinet. But what does that mean in this case? What kind of diversity are we really talking about here?
I'd like to give a nod to a journalist who I recently had the opportunity to interview, Roberto Lovato, who has a fantastic book right now on the violence and the interconnectedness of El Salvador and the United States. But he calls this intersectional empire. And that's what we're seeing under Joe Biden, is that we're bringing in all these figures to just have a more multicultural kind of an empire. You know, it's basically going to be an empire that looks like our country. And that's something that people are going to have to confront head on and stop falling for appointing, you know, women or Latinos or gays and lesbians or transgender people. You know, like, without going too far away from, I want to highlight Avril Haines specifically because I think she deserves attention, but without going too far away, there's actually a transgender person who was on his agency review team for his Biden, for the Biden transition. And I couldn't help but laugh because it's a transgender person who's a vet, but it's also somebody who's a contractor for CACI, which was involved in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, was implicated. So the representation that transgender people are getting in Biden's transition is coming from a contractor guilty of torture in Iraq. That's not representation, I think. I think we have to be clear here. I'm not trying to denigrate any group of people, but I'm saying if you really want representation, you need to be putting more demands on political elites, because what you don't want is reinforcing the white heteronormative patriarchy. And I think, like, it's fair to put it that way, because what they're doing is they're weaponizing you against people around the world. And so you have Avril Haines who's coming in. The director of national intelligence position is what she's been picked to be a part of. And she's significant because she is a John Brennan loyalist. She was at the CIA. She was involved in further entrenching the assassination complex for drone warfare and the kill list. She's involved in, you know, they celebrate her as if, like, she was concerned about international law, and she forced them to have a better process and to do more and then just quit killing people every Terror Tuesday with reckless abandon. But what this means is that it just became a more formal part of U.S. government. It was no longer easy to question what Barack Obama was doing. I mean, as he even admits in his latest memoir, he talks about how, like, easy it was to be killing people, essentially. And so, you know, that's what she was involved in. And she came from Palantir, too. She was at Palantir, which is a major security contractor that is implicated in, like, the deportations of immigrants. And the thing that's remarkable, too, is she was at a think tank called CNAS that is funded by oil companies, weapons companies, but it also got money from the director of national intelligence, that office which she is now going to be a chair of or running as a director. And then it also received money from Palantir. So it's just amazing, like, when you think about the revolving doors of these people, it's just so incestuous.
So speaking of actually obtaining something substantive, what are progressives getting from this administration and these cabinet picks? People were told that they have to vote for Joe Biden, that he's the lesser of two evils, and once he's elected, you can push him left. Okay, well, I don't see Bernie Sanders' name anywhere on this list. So what are progressives getting exactly from this administration?
The only thing that I think you could say we might gain from a Biden administration is that we won't be bombing Iran. But we also know that we were never going to do that unless the Pentagon changed its calculus, because they've always had their own analysis that says that they would never be able to succeed militarily the way they want to. And so that's always held them back from doing more than just like enlisting Israel to go assassinate nuclear scientists, or engaging in cyber warfare with things like Stuxnet to just completely dismantle the infrastructure. That's Barack Obama. That's where Joe Biden is going next. We're going to see that kind of hybrid warfare. And so I think people really need to be aware that what we have now with a Joe Biden administration is a ramping up of tensions with Russia, a ramping up of tensions with China. The great power competition is going to be extremely fierce. And then with Iran, like, I don't know what they're supposed to do. The government and all the officials didn't do anything wrong when it came to the nuclear deal. Donald Trump decided to completely scrap it. And then now, somehow, in order to get the U.S. back into it, I'm afraid that Joe Biden's going to force Iran to make some kind of concessions, even though they never left the deal. So why should they have to do it? Like, why should they have to be the ones that give anything up? It should be the United States that gives Iran something in order to be back in the nuclear deal, in order to have this agreement. And so I think you asked the right question, which is, what are progressives gaining from this cabinet when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, look at the bill that just passed for the government that had the stimulus package. It contains funding for democracy promotion programs. It contains funding for more of the intervention and regime change operations in Venezuela. It contains funding for the war on drugs in the Caribbean. It contains funding for helping activists continue to destabilize Hong Kong, just so that they can drive a wedge between China and any other countries in the region that it's trying to work with and cooperate with. And so I'm really concerned here. And then the other thing with these people who are in the cabinet that we have to address is that they're completely hawkish on Syria and favor arms being sent to Syria. And also, you've had situations where the Pentagon's funding their own groups that end up going to war with CIA-funded groups. So it's a total satire.
Right. I mean, these picks are total jokes. Pete Buttigieg, a small-town mayor, he's now the transport secretary. The former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, you know, her field of so-called expertise is predominantly foreign policy, yet now she'll be leading the domestic policy council. What are all these weird picks? Is there something transactional or nefarious going on here, as opposed to something based on expertise?
It's transactional. And let me just disclose that I'm actually from the same hometown area that Pete Buttigieg is from. So I have a little insight into the fact that, you know, as far as his transportation experience, he really has none. But what I can tell you is there's a commuter train that runs between that area. There's a commuter train that runs between Chicago and northern Indiana that now he'll be able to use the same way that Mitch McConnell's wife was able to use as transportation secretary. So you know what this means is that he'll be able to jump to the front of line and get federal grants funneled to northern Indiana ahead of every other part of the United States. So it's just going to be an opportunity for Pete Buttigieg to get the gravy train going and put him in a good spot so that he can run for president again and make everybody feel good that he did a nice job as transportation secretary. Meanwhile, he has no knowledge of these systems. And then you raise the issue of Susan Rice. She couldn't get confirmed in a Senate. She never could get confirmed in the Senate because of what she did in Libya. So what are they going to do? Give her a domestic policy council position, which has nothing to do with her field of expertise at all.
I think it's frankly hilarious that anyone would expect anything different from a candidate who told rich donors that nothing would fundamentally change. we can clearly see that Joe Biden is not only returning the favor to those who stood aside for him to clinch the presidency, but just like all presidents before him, he is catering to the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, and the rest of corporate America. Once again, we see the formation of a cabinet run not by the American people, but by the oligarchy and multinational corporations. Joe Biden may be appointing all these women, women of color, people of color, to his cabinet. His cabinet might be diverse in race, orientation, and gender, but it is by no means diverse in terms of policy. What's the point of having a black Secretary of Defense if he's going to keep bombing black and brown people on the other side of the planet? What's the point of appointing a woman Director of National Intelligence if she helps drone strike and displace other women? You know, if Biden cares about women, wouldn't it have been better to not support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen that has forced critical essential services and clinics to shut down, leaving scores of women without the necessary medical services that they require? As Eric London writes a few weeks ago, quote, "These servants of Wall Street and U.S. imperialism have nothing in common with the working people of their own race, gender, or sexual orientation. It is class, not identity, which is the fundamental dividing line in American society." This intersectional imperialism is just a facade in order to continue the same brutal policies of the U.S. empire, exploiting workers, killing and robbing people of color, all for the enrichment of the corporate elites. This pandering is an attempt to portray Biden's incoming administration as being more inclusive and diverse, implying that its tenure will be more in tune to the needs of these same minorities. But at the end of the day, these cabinet picks are all part of the same DC clique. They've spent their entire careers serving corporate interests and climbing the political ladder, and the last thing on their minds is serving the needs of their constituents, never mind those of their same race, gender, or orientation. Many people around the globe are rightfully cautious and skeptical about anything changing under Biden, and very conscious of the fact that the American empire continues just as it is, regardless of who is in the driver's seat. It's time, perhaps, for Americans to wake up to that as well. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about how to manage our lives. In the previous program, we talked about time management. In this program, I would like to speak more about financial management, which is also important. You might be surprised that Islam has talked about financial management. And we mentioned consumerism. We mentioned capitalism in our modern life and how it affects us, and we should have financial management whenever we want to spend money. And moderation here is the key in all spheres of life, not only in financial management, but in time management, in all the things that you do in your life. Moderation is the key. Even in the case of charity, sadaqah, when you want to give charity, Almighty Allah urges moderation. And do not make your hand shackled to your neck, nor stretch it out completely lest you sit down blamed, stripped off. Chapter 17, verse 29. Once the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi saw a companion using excessive water for wudu, the ritual ablution for prayers. And he said to that companion, "Why are you wasting the water?" This dear companion by the name of Sa'd was surprised and asked, "There is israf even in water for wudu?" The Prophet replied, "Yes, even if you are by a flowing river." Subhanallah. Even if you are side by side with a flowing river, you should not waste water. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi said, "Verily, there are some people from my ummah, from my nation, whose prayers will not be answered." Why? Number one, a person who prays against his parents. Number two, a person who prays against a debtor, someone who is in debt, who has taken his money, property, and the creditor neither wrote down the loan agreement nor had it witnessed. Number three, a person who prays against his wife while Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given him the right to divorce him by himself. So if you are not satisfied with your wife, why are you praying against her? There are other ways. Number four, a person who sits at home and prays, "Oh my Lord, give me sustenance, give me my rizq," but does not go out to seek the sustenance of Allah. Allah will say, "Oh my servant, did I not provide the means for you to seek and exploit the earth with healthy limbs? If you had done this, then you would have the excuse between me and you for your sustenance, because you followed my command, and so that you may not be a burden on your family." And number six, a person who was blessed by Allah with plentiful wealth, which he gave away in charity, and now he prays, "Oh my Lord, give me sustenance." Allah would say, "Did I not give you ample wealth? Then why did you not manage it as I had ordered you? And why did you practice extravagance while I have forbidden you from extravagance?" So we should have financial management, dear brothers and sisters, in all the things that we do that has to do with money. Have financial management, and you will see that your life will prosper, and you will or might have a more joyful life. That is one aspect of having a joyful life that should not be declined. We should not neglect that part. The financial aspect is one important aspect for us human beings to have a joyful life. And Islam does not deny you that, but you should have time management and financial management in your life.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West when in fact all
walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
When we continue this aspect and we reach the part when you want to deal with your customers, you should know that property have sanctity.